Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News and by Skype, Peter Granitz of APRN. Steve, Governor Sean Parnell delivered his annual State of the State message this week. Walk us through it. What were some of the high points of what the governor had to say?
Well, some of the high points is, you know, it's not loaded with specifics, but State of the State, State of the Union addresses, they never really are. This is more of a broad brushstroke kind of a picture that outlines where the governor wants to take the state over the next 3 months during the legislative session and beyond. One of the things that he said before we got to all the nuts and bolts of what he wanted is, he said in his speech, he said, this is the voice of history. We must answer its call. We must not only listen to voters who cast their ballots in the last election, but also future generations. And this was a nice way of saying, yeah, we really stuck it to the Democrats last November. The bipartisan coalition is no more in the Senate. So now we can do all the cool stuff that we've really been wanting to do. And some of the things that he wants to do is, of course, he wants to change the tax rate.
On oil.
He's proposing a 25% flat tax rate for the oil industry. He's trying to spur more production here in the state of Alaska. We've seen production dwindling. And of course, Democrats in the bipartisan coalition over the last couple of years have bitterly opposed what the governor's been trying to do and have been able to hold them off for the most part. Now they find themselves definitely in the minority. They're still opposed to this. They're still speaking out against it, say that the governor's plan is going to cost the state about $1 billion a year. But the governor says it's also an investment into the future. We'll see increases in oil production. Now, oil wasn't the only thing he talked about. He talked about the gas pipeline. He gave more benchmarks to the oil industry, saying by February 15th, he wants to see what a natural gas pipeline would look like conceptually.
Steve, it seems to me that, and to others, this was pointed out to me, really, that he would only be asking for benchmarks, or however he phrased it, by the 15th of next month if he knew he was going to get an answer.
I would think so. Last year he did the same thing and was quite successful. I mean, he didn't say anything like, you know, I want to see the first segment of pipe actually put in place. I mean, that would be impossible at this point in time. But he wants to see the oil industry doing field work this summer. He wants to see a full season of field work. He wants to know how big this pipeline would be, the diameter, how much natural gas would be flowing through the line. So he's asking for some real specifics, and I would think that they're doable.
A couple more quick things here.
Yeah,
one
sure.
is he went out of his way. I don't know if he went out of his way, but he certainly made it a point to announce that Washington would not be allowed to inhibit our destiny.
Yeah.
And it was interesting to me that he referred to it as Washington, and he also said that's the way Washington is. He did not use the words or the name Barack Obama.
No, he didn't. He didn't. And I think it's, you know, that's always
it just would be tacky in that kind of speech.
Right. He did talk about Washington, and he talked about how the state was a leading star and far more effective and then what the federal government has done, what Washington is doing. And we should also point out, though, that the governor did hit on some themes that have been very near and dear to his heart at the very beginning. He led off with his speech talking about how he wants to continue his work against sexual assault.
Violence against women.
Violence against women, yeah. Domestic violence, violence against children. Mm-hmm. And he outlined some ideas there that would continue that work. Those are some big goals of his, and he wants to see more progress there. So,
okay, let's go to Peter Granitz in Washington. Peter, Congress has been largely formally inactive, although there have been meetings all over Washington and preparations for the inauguration continue. But the House and then the Senate did pass the Sandy Relief Bill, but Alaska didn't have anything in it.
That's right. I should say the Senate passed it last Congress, and congressional rules dictate that whatever work's done but left unfinished by the time the new Congress gavels in needs to be restarted. So what we saw earlier this week was the House passed the second installment of this Congress. A couple of weeks ago, they passed a $10 billion extension of the federal flood insurance program. So this week, they came back with about $50 billion in aid, most of it directed to the Northeast. There's a big debate in the House about whether, and the Senate, about whether this should be a Sandy bill or this should be a disaster bill. A number of folks from Alaska thought it should be a disaster bill. The Senate version that passed last year had $150 million for fishery disasters across the country. Now, that was on the YK Delta, Upper Cook Inlet, and then Massachusetts, New Hampshire, the Gulf states, the Mississippi River. That was whittled down in the House in this bill to $5 million. And then one amendment passed right at the end that said of that $5 million, it can only go to the Sandy-affected states. So there's no fishery disaster money. And there was another bit of money in the original Senate plan for $60 million for marine debris research. Now, this was spun in a way that says, oh, the Hurricane Sandy states also have marine debris washing ashore as well, so this is not just for the Pacific states. That's not going to make it to the Pacific either. Any money that's in there is going to stay on the East Coast. It's worth noting that the Alaska folks wanted this in there, but there were some reservations. Senator Murkowski, leading up to it, said she worried about the size and the scope of this, and she thought it was really important more than anything to get the money out the door to those who needed it most. So she voted against, or she voted for, forgive me, she voted for a measure that would have pared it down a bit. That failed, and then she voted for overall passage. I talked to Congressman Young after the vote, was it Tuesday night, I believe, and he said, you know what, the Alaska provisions probably should not have been in there in the first place. We tried, we didn't get it in. We'll have to try next year in the appropriations process.
Peter, I wanted to ask you, how did Don Young vote on this measure? Did he vote with the leadership? Only about a third of the Republicans did, and the measure couldn't have passed without the Democratic votes.
He did. He tends to support the speaker. He is a party guy. He does have a bit of loyalty to Speaker Boehner. I mean, Speaker Boehner has been in some position of leadership since, I want to say, the mid-90s when he took over the Education Committee. And Don Young appreciates people who came up on committees, those who have led on the ground fight on actual legislation. And he's got a bit of loyalty to the speaker, I think, for that reason. He did vote with him for that. He also voted with his party on something that, you know, a number didn't. I think there was 100 or so who voted for amendment that ultimately failed that said, you know what, we need to offset this. We need to cut 1.6 or 1.8% out of every federal budget to pay for this. That went down, and I think that kind of sets the standard that we've, you know, or retain the standard that, you know, disaster funding doesn't need offset funding.
Right. Okay. One other thing that Congress has been working on is committee assignments. And we learned that Senator Mark Begich will now be on the Appropriations Committee, usually a sought after seat. Tell us more, Peter.
Notice you say usually. And there's a thought that maybe the Appropriations Committee isn't that fun anymore. We see, you know, the new Senate pro tem, Patrick Leahy, a liberal Democrat from Vermont, he took over for the late Senator Daniel Inouye, who passed away late last year, or this year, I should say. He could have taken the chair of the Appropriations Committee, but opted to stay on Judiciary. And I think that's a sign of the times that, you know what, in a time of shrinking federal budgets, it's not that fun to be on a committee that's in charge of doling out money. So we do see a new chair, Senator Barbara Mikulski. She's the longest serving woman in the Senate in history. She's from Baltimore City, right up the road from us. And she's the first woman to chair the Appropriations Committee. And Senator Begich did land on this. I was surprised. I didn't know he was looking for it. I suppose hindsight's 20/20. And when we see that he put those provisions in the relief bill to get marine debris money and fishery disaster money, maybe he was actually trying to get a little practice for the Appropriations Committee. Maybe he needs a little bit more.
But that's what committee, Peter, if I can interrupt you because I can't see you or can't exchange eye contact here. What committee is Begich coming off?
He is leaving the Armed Services to come on, the Armed Services Committee to come on Appropriations. That surprised me because he had told me in the past that he would like to move up on that committee and maybe get a subcommittee chairmanship there. He does chair the Ocean Subcommittee on Commerce, which is important to the state, and he's really happy to retain that. But he gave up Armed Services, and that was a shocker. He also is leaving the Budget Committee to go on to Indian Affairs, which was a bit of a surprise. The Budget Committee, he is saying, it's more of a perfunctory thing. The real legwork of spending in the government and paying for things happens in the Appropriations Committee. And there's a bit of truth in that. The Senate hasn't passed a budget in 3-4 years or something like that. But the Budget Committee is going to be wildly important in the next couple of months as we approach yet more fiscal deadlines and cliffs and whatever you want to call them. It would require every member of the Budget Committee to get on board and say, these are the strong Democratic principles I support or oppose. He doesn't have to do that as no longer a member of the Budget Committee.
Anything to add about the committee assignments of the other members of our delegation?
Yeah, the other two are staying the same. Congressman Young will stay on natural resources and infrastructure and transportation and infrastructure. He's chaired both of them. The Republicans in the House have a rule that says you can only be the chair or the ranking member for 6 years. He's long gone past that. He retains his chairmanship of a subcommittee on Alaska Natives and American Indians. He likes that committee. It gives him something to do, and it's something he's interested in. Senator Murkowski is the number two the number one Republican, forgive me, on the Energy Committee again. She's going to be working with Oregon Senator Ron Wyden, and they seem to have a really good relationship right now. There's rumors that there's going to be some early movement or movement at some point this year on a revenue sharing bill. We'll see how that pans out. The issue between the two of them, though, is they don't see eye to eye on exporting natural gas. So we'll see how that relationship develops. Also worth noting is that she will keep the appropriation, the top Republican spot on the Appropriations Subcommittee on the Interior.
Okay, once again, I'm Michael Carey, and I'm here with Peter Granitz and Steve McDonald. Steve, headline in the Anchorage Daily News, federal agents would face arrest under Alaska gun bill.
Yeah, this is something that Representative Chenault, Mike Chenault, has proposed. He says any federal agent who would restrict gun rights here in Alaska ought to be charged with a misdemeanor. I don't understand this at all. I've seen a lot of.
I think, Steve, we're in the land of political symbolism, but at the same time, members have an obligation to uphold the Constitution.
Yeah, but I think this is symbolism. I think it's more about maintaining our A rating with the NRA here. I don't see this as a real issue. And with all the things the legislature has on its plate, do they really have to take the time to deal with this? Perhaps it won't get out of a committee. Maybe it'll stay in a committee. Maybe it won't. Maybe it'll rocket through and it'll get to the floor, but they don't have a lot of time. And they've got some
big
issues.
My guess is you've got the speaker's name on it. That should give it some weight, huh?
Yeah. Well,
on the other hand, maybe he just wants to introduce the bill.
Yeah. It's not the first time that a bill similar to this has come up. 2010, another piece of legislation along the same lines came up. It's never been put to the test. There's some questions about whether or not it's constitutional. There's going to be questions about whether this one is constitutional. If it's ever enacted, that's when we would find out, I imagine, if somebody would file a lawsuit against it. But you could kind of see this coming. And yes, the constituency up here is pro-gun. So he's preaching to the choir here, I think.
Okay. Peter, speaking of gun control, President Obama could force Senator Mark Begich into some pretty tough votes here, wouldn't you say?
He could also force Senator Murkowski into some pretty tough votes. All three members, not just the two of them, but also Don Young, have very high A ratings from the National Rifle Association. They are pro-gun legislators. Mark Begich, it was hard for a while to figure out where exactly he stood. It took me about three interviews with him to figure out that for him to come out and say, he does not support reinstating the assault weapons ban. And I learned earlier today from his office that he wouldn't support any new laws, is they phrase it, that they need to enforce the existing ones. Now, that means no new laws on banning high-capacity magazines, which is something the president would like to do, no new laws that would be required to close the gun show loophole, as it's known. Some 40% of gun sales are done privately and don't require a background check. He wouldn't support something like that. He and the rest of the delegation does support increased funding or some kind of way to investigate the link between those who are mentally ill and gun ownership and try to get guns out of the hands of those who shouldn't be owning them. That's somewhere where they all agree. I learned recently, and it's probably common knowledge, that Congressman Young is on the board of directors of the National Rifle Association. They've really bailed him out when he needed it, when he had that really close race in 2008. They gave him more than $10,000. He penned an op-ed for them in the USA Today earlier this week, the last week, saying, you know what, I fundamentally question what the president is doing here. He used the term aesthetically altered. He doesn't want the president to regulate aesthetically altered guns. I think that implies that he says that these are the way the gun looks and not necessarily the way the gun functions.
Okay. Peter, I'm sort of wondering, it seems that the subject of mental health is something Congress has really been focusing on. There's some people who wonder about Congress, as dysfunctional as it's been, being worried about mental health, but it does seem that the mental health question is sort of bottomless. I mean, how much money and what kind of a program what would all this entail? Has there been any discussion of specifics other than lamenting the fact that some mentally disturbed people have done terrible things?
It's hard to envision what this would look like. And I have not seen anything concrete yet. It's not to say something is not coming. One of the things the president did sign was he overturned a rule that says the National Institutes of Health cannot look at or cannot study the gun violence's effect on as a public health concern. So that hasn't been looked at in years. So that's one thing that they're moving. But in terms of mental health, it seems like that would have to be done at the state level, doesn't it? Because that's where a lot of the people interact. You know, it's, you know, local municipalities and in state registries and things like that. You know, there's this call for having a database of those who are mentally ill. I think you're going to see a lot of civil libertarians have problems.
That's right. And there's a huge discussion of what is the definition of mentally ill. And New York State just passed a law the other day that would require therapists to report patients who make certain kinds of statements apparently about violence, although it seems very amorphous. I don't know if Congress would be interested in that. Probably not, probably specific to New York State, but that's what you have.
Yeah, and there's, you know, we look back at Virginia Tech, was it 2007 in Blacksburg. There's stories about a perpetrator there, you know, who had gone through the system before and, you know, wasn't reported or was reported to no avail. And I don't remember the specifics, but the mental health system isn't catching everybody it needs to, and I think there's a lot of agreement on that. But nobody really wants to give a concrete explanation as to how to fix it. You know, more money might be the answer in some people's eyes. Better therapists might be the answer in other people's eyes. But we don't have anything in front of us, and that is going to be a very hard thing to do because it's very nebulous.
Yeah, and the number of people who commit multiple homicides is small, and the number who have been had some contact with the mental health system is even smaller. Steve McDonald, Representative Lindsey Holm, the former Democrat, becomes a Republican, the fourth-term House member. Why'd she switch?
The reason she switched was, in her words, to become more effective in the legislature. She would, of course, be a minority member of being a Democrat in the House. She's been given a position on the Finance Committee, I think. So it's a very powerful committee. You're controlling the purse strings. So this gives her a real place at the table in terms of how money is spent here in the state of Alaska. She feels she's got more power. She's in a position now where she can do more for her constituents. The real question here is she waited until, 2 months after the election, basically, to announce that she had changed parties. This is a decision that I would guess, I haven't asked her, but I imagine this is something that has been weighing on her mind for quite some time. A lot of people felt that if she was contemplating doing this, she should have done it at the beginning of the campaign so people would get an accurate picture of who they were voting for, a Republican or a Democrat. Not the vast majority of people, but there are more registered Republicans in her district than registered Democrats.
It did vote for Obama, I believe, didn't they?
I don't think they really don't follow party lines in that district. Part of that district is the area that's represented by Senator Hollis French. So it's been an area that's supported Democratic candidates for many, many years. So she's really taken some hits from her former colleagues in the Democratic side of things. Some constituents have been writing letters, in notes on Facebook, things like that, where they're pretty angry about the fact that she kept this so close to the vest and waited until after the election. So I think she's going to take some hits. The advantage she has is she's not up for re-election until 2014.
Yeah, the classic explanation of people switching parties is you make enemies of the people who used to be the party you used to be, and then the people in the party you joined don't necessarily trust you.
Well, that's
I don't
that's
know if
true,
that'd
yeah.
be true in this case, but you have to wonder.
I don't know either. You know, I do know that she's a good lawmaker. She's a nice person, a good lawmaker. I think she's been a cooperative person in the legislature. I think she's reached across the aisle to work with Republicans in the past. She's got a good reputation as a thoughtful lawmaker.
And it's very unusual. I don't know, very unusual, but it is unusual when people switch parties and become so personal.
Yeah.
Scott Kawasaki, a Fairbanks Democrat, lost his seat on the House Finance Committee and mm-hmm. was replaced by Holmes. And if he's reaching across the aisle, he may have something in his hand when it comes to her. Right?
when it does. But again, time, I think people are pretty forgiving, and she's not up for election again until 2014. So by then, maybe she'll have mended fences with the people who are
One thing I did check for the viewers is on the recall possibilities, and the Democratic lawyer explained to me, who's very familiar with the law, that it require signatures of 25% of the voters, of the people who voted in the last election in her district. So this would be pretty much of a stretch. It would take a tremendous amount of time, money, resources, and there'd be a whole question about whether this would be, from the Democrats' point of view, time well spent. Right. Peter, the debt ceiling has been haunting Washington, could have some ramifications for Alaska. What have you heard?
Well, what we're seeing today, there are reports out of this House Republican retreat down in Williamsburg, Virginia, that they are agreeing to extend the debt ceiling for 2-3 months, a short period of time. That already, their Democrats, Chris Van Hollen, the ranking member in the House Budget Committee, came out and said that gives zero certainty to businesses. To be clear, you know, we talked about the fiscal cliff and how bad that would be. Defaulting on the nation's debt would be catastrophic. Any gains that we've made would be wiped away. This would be calamitous at best. But they say that they're going to move it on 2-3 months or so. I spoke with Congressman Young a couple of weeks ago about this. I want to say a week and a half, 2 weeks ago. And he said, and it surprised me, that he thought this was the time to leverage cuts. He tends to go with the speaker, and the speaker has been a little quiet on this one. But the president is trying to delineate between the two things, that the debt ceiling is paying for bills incurred already versus future spending, which would be where you would want to cut from. And Senator Murkowski, I think it was with the Fairbanks Daily News Miner, said, no, this is not the time to leverage cuts. This is the time to pay the bills. We'll talk about cuts in the future. This is not where it is. And it's 2-3 months. You know what that's going to do? It's going to make it coincide with the sequester. It's going to make it coincide with the continuing resolution, which is the bill that's currently funding the government, until that expires. So we're looking at 2-3 months of this stuff. And if you thought it was over at New Year's, or if you got tired of the phrase so-called fiscal cliff, it's running right back at you.
Okay. Quickly, in perhaps a minute or less, Peter, can you tell us, Interior Secretary Kenneth Salazar is retiring. Does he have a legacy, and who are the potential replacements?
A legacy, he has carried the president's water. That may be coy, but the president has always touted his all-of-the-above strategy, and that's something that the secretary has always said, that, you know, we support traditional fossil fuels, we support renewables. If there's a legacy, maybe it's that.
Replacements? Possible replacements?
I have heard two names floated more than others, and that's John Barry, who's currently the head of the Office of Personnel Management, which basically oversees every government worker in the federal government, and also former Washington Governor Christine Gregoire.
Okay, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much, Peter. Steve, we were talking about the schools and teaching earlier.
Yeah.
Senator Bob Lynn has a bill that would arm school staff. What's in the bill, and what are its prospects?
Well, training for teachers and if districts decide they want to arm teachers to protect students from what happened up at Sandy Hook Elementary School, and this is something that you, I think of some districts across the country and perhaps even the districts here in Anchorage or the district here in Anchorage will have to consider at some point in time. But Representative Lynn, again, a gun advocate, feels that arming teachers would add a measure of protection. There are already officers in schools and high schools here. I don't know how it would change the dynamics and the atmosphere in a school, knowing that
the art teacher's packing.
I don't know if that how that changes the dynamics and the atmosphere in school. Do you want to? The question you have to ask is, do you want to turn your schools into armed camps?
It'd be interesting to see what comes up at the hearings and if the NEA testified and the Organization of School Principals and so forth.
We had a similar debate after 9/11 when a number of Congress people said we should give guns to pilots. And there were pilots who came out and said, no, there should not be guns on airplanes.
No is the message I have, unfortunately, to deliver. We're out of time. Next week, I will be away. I'll be out of town. But Lori Townsend will be right here with Alaska Edition.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at AlaskaEdition@alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.